Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, and historians and talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Michael Vorenberg, an associate professor of history who's also an award-winning author of several military history books focusing on the American Civil War. One of his novels was actually used as a source in the Spielberg film Lincoln, which is pretty cool. And he's also the author of today's book, Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the American Civil War. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Emily. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's a very, very easy read, even if you're not super familiar with a lot of details of the Civil War. You're not going to be overwhelmed, but there's a lot of information in there. I would say what stood out to me overall of kind of this idea of the book was that you can't just declare peace. You have to go through all this negotiation and efforts and mountains to climb and things to actually get peace. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment. As someone said in a different context, not in the Civil War, that it's harder to end a war than to fight a war. I can't remember who said that and what war it was, but I suppose that's maybe true of all wars in all times. Mm. But that doesn't stop people from declaring a war over, right? So that's one of the things that caught my eye here is, you know, can you declare a war over? Absolutely, you can declare a war over. Does that make a war over? Of course not. And yet over and over again, we see this happening, and including in the Civil War.
Yeah, absolutely. I think almost the stuff that happened after the Civil War was declared over is just as interesting as everything that came before it, because it definitely was not over when we said it was over. Can you tell us a brief description of what the Hamptons Road Conference was and what went down during that meeting?
Sure. The Hampton Roads Conference happens in early February of 1865. It's before we typically think of the war being over. So let me just use as a marker here, April 9, 1865. That's a marker because that's when Lee surrenders to Grant. And I'm just going to hold that date as a point, because I think when you ask people when the war ends, that's the most common endpoint. And yeah, it's a useful endpoint. So April 9. So now let's go back 2 months, a little bit more than 2 months, to early February. And what's happened is that three envoys are making their way to Washington, D.C., and they claim to be envoys, official envoys of the Confederacy. Whether they really have the power to negotiate or not really remains to be seen. And they make their trip north from Richmond. And this actually is in the Spielberg film, Lincoln. This is an important part of the film, because news that they're on their way comes into Congress while Congress is debating the 13th Amendment. And it leads people to say, wait a minute, stop the debate. We don't want to end slavery if it's going to somehow, that could mess with the negotiations that could be happening. So there's this great sequence in the film where Lincoln sort of carefully chooses his words when he sends a message to Congress saying, to my knowledge, no one is on their way to Washington. And that's because he knows that they're not coming to Washington. He's basically got them in Hampton Roads, which, if you don't know your Virginia geography, it's kind of near Newport. And so there they are. 13th Amendment is passed by Congress, sent to the states for ratification. That's January 31st. And right away, Lincoln and Seward, his Secretary of State, head down to Virginia. And they meet with three envoys on board the River Queen. The River Queen is a paddle boat. And there, they discuss a number of things. What doesn't happen is a discussion about the end of the war. This is not a peace negotiation. The Lincoln, it's really important to recognize his position. His position is that the Civil War is a fight between the United States on one side and rebels on the other. The Confederacy is not a legitimate nation. And the Lincoln administration always takes that position. Because it's not a legitimate nation, he can't be seen as negotiating with the Confederacy, because he's spent the whole time in office saying this is not a nation. You can't secede and create a nation. So there has to be other reasons to have this talk. And so they talk about a number of things. It's really quite an interesting talk. They talk about, among other things, they talk about the 13th Amendment that just was adopted.
Sure, yeah.
The issue comes up, basically, what has to happen for the war to end? And Lincoln says, same things that I've always said. You know, you have to renounce, you have to join the Union, you have to swear to the Constitution, renounce secession, and approve all the acts that Congress has done, which includes emancipation. So it's the same line he's been using publicly since 1864. These are the terms that are non-negotiable. You come back to the Union, loyalty to the Constitution, renounce secession, and adhere to emancipation. It's that last one now, which is even stronger because the 13th Amendment has been adopted.
Yeah.
So the discussion ends, the envoys go back, and there you go. And the war continues.
And the war continues.
Yes.
Right. Right. It is interesting when you talk about the idea of the South being rebels, like it's not an actual war. It reminds me of the American Revolution a little bit, where Britain didn't see us as like a legitimate country. They're like, you're just a bunch of rebels. So rules of warfare and how we have to treat you don't apply. So in the Civil War, it was kind of the same way, where the North is like, you guys are just rebels. Like, what are you even doing? Can you lead us through a little bit of the international repercussions that this kind of half in, half out, like you're rebels, so you can't negotiate with other countries, but we're at war with you. So like, it's kind of half in, half out. What was the fallout of that?
Yeah. Well, I like the way you connect it to the American Revolution. Mm. There is a connection, obviously, right? And you said it exactly right. From the view of the British Empire, the revolutionary Americans are just rebels. But let's stick with that for a second.
Okay.
So eventually, of course, what is it that America wants in the revolution? Well, they want independence and they want their own nation. So to get that, they have to be recognized as a nation. Obviously, England doesn't recognize them as a nation.
Right.
One of the reasons why they want recognition as a nation is because under international law, foreign countries cannot interfere in the domestic affairs of a different country.
Right.
So let's focus now on France and the American Revolution, right? Mm-hmm. France can't just aid the U.S. with arms and men, soldiers. It can, but to do so is a violation of international law. Mm. Now, it does happen that France and England have their conflict going on. So what the United States really wants is for France to recognize the U.S. as a nation. Once France does that, then they can make the alliance, right? This is exactly what happens during the revolution. Now, why do I talk about this when I'm talking about the Civil War? When you see things from the Confederacy's point of view, this is exactly how they see themselves. They see themselves as sort of American Revolution 2.0. They're being treated as nothing but rebels by the U.S. government. However, if they can get foreign countries to recognize them as a legitimate nation, England, France especially, would be key, then they are, in effect, a foreign nation. And then, under international law, those countries can come to aid them. So the game that's being played here by the U.S. diplomatically is, first, we don't recognize them as a nation, that they make that very clear, they're not a nation. And then Seward, the Secretary of State, and his operatives in Europe are making sure that France, England, everyone else understands they are not a nation. And so for this reason, those places declare neutrality. And that's so that's what happens. But from the Confederate point of view, of course, they're a nation. And right. But when is a nation, right? So a nation is a nation when you declare yourselves a nation, but you're not really a nation until other nations admit you into the club. And you become a nation within the club. You're recognized, and that's international law in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a really cool explanation of that. And that brings me to one of my other questions. One of the fascinating things about history is the Mexican Civil War and their stuff, which was actually started, I think, the same year as our Civil War, just to the south of us. And that makes me wonder about they had that European emperor, that Habsburg, that was like, we're going to be the emperor of the Mexican throne, and all these anti-monarchy Mexican side was like, no, we're going to overthrow you. We're not going to have you. And so there's this civil war. What was the whole deal with the Confederates, the U.S. Confederates, offering some bargain or some deal to try to get recognition from Mexico? What was that?
Yes. So let me step back and explain what's going on a little bit in Mexico, because I guess when we talk about the Mexican Revolution, people tend to think of that as happening rather later than the Civil War. But you're right. It is absolutely, I suppose it's a revolution. It's more like a civil war, depending on how you want to count the revolution. The revolution, the break from Spain happens earlier. But here's what's going on. Actually, the key actor here is France. Napoleon III. Napoleon III, who Americans know as Louis Napoleon, nephew of Napoleon I, Napoleon Bonaparte. So Napoleon III has plans, grand schemes. And part of the grand design, as it's known, is to reestablish a French presence in the Americas. Mm. And he sends his French army to Mexico. Now, all of this has nothing to do with the American Civil War yet, right? So this is just Napoleon doing his thing with Mexico.
We got to know the backstory.
Yes. Yeah. So he sends French troops to Mexico, and they take control of the capital, and he installs as emperor of Mexico Maximilian. That's your Habsburg Austrian emperor, right? Puppet emperor, Maximilian, who is propped up by Napoleon's armies. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's Maximilian in Mexico, which, by the way, is a pretty clear violation of the Monroe Doctrine. So the Monroe Doctrine, right, is saying that, right, we don't know no U.S. or European entanglements in Central and South America.
Stay out of here.
Stay out of here. And here they are. All right. So now Maximilian's fully in place by 1862. The war is going on. Now the Civil War is broken out by 1861. And as I said, the Confederates are looking for allies in all sorts of places. And one of these places is France. So it's natural that when they're talking to operatives in France, that they're saying, look, we can help you, Napoleon, in your struggle in Mexico, because it was a struggle. It wasn't like the country went down easily. Benito Juarez and the Juaristas, the Mexicans, right, they're at war with the French troops. They are Mexican, and they want their country for Mexico.
Yeah.
And so the Confederacy is willing to make whatever promises it'll take to get allies. So the issue of, hey, let's make a deal is on the table. But again, if they make a deal, then that's France recognizing the Confederacy, and that has its own problems. My book is focusing on the end of the war. And when you get towards the end of the war, and the Confederacy really is clearly in trouble, and it looks like they're going to lose, France and Mexico become this, the great dream. Like, this is what will save us.
Right.
And here again, actually, the comparison to the American Revolution works. And they kept on invoking the American Revolution, right? Mm. American Revolution. Revolutionaries have their back to the wall. There's nothing left. France will save us. And sure enough,
right.
France saved them, right? France saved the revolution. So the Confederacy's like, this is just going to be history replaying itself. So we're going to have our people talk to Napoleon. We're going to send envoys, maybe talk to Maximilian as well, and work out a deal. And that deal, we're not quite sure what that deal looks like. It doesn't matter because nothing happened. But like many schemes, there's many ways it could go. But one possibility is, yeah, the Confederacy will help Maximilian defeat the Juaristas once and for all. And in exchange, once that's done, Maximilian and the French troops will, with the Confederacy, right, invade the U.S. on the side of the Confederates, and the war that what is basically almost over, it'll fan the flames, and the Confederacy will be back in business as an army.
And why didn't that happen? Why didn't that go down very well?
Well, diplomacy can work. And Seward's agents working with the French are convincing the French not to do this.
Yeah.
Why doesn't France go for the deal, right? And I think it's important to remember that it isn't just about highbrow diplomacy, it's about money. And if you're England and you're France, you're making effectively bets. Everything is about the cotton, right? And what is going to happen to the cotton? This is the biggest cotton supplier to the world, the south of the U.S. And so if the Confederacy is going to lose, and the odds are that if it looks like they're going to lose, you do not want to be on the bad side of the United States when the U.S. has control of the cotton stores and you have an economy that's tied so deeply to the textile industry, right? So this is the economics behind the game.
So that was part of what was going on near the end of the Civil War was, you know, we didn't have other countries internationally recognizing the Confederacy as its own nation. And the North was going around making sure that everybody knew that that was a good idea to not recognize them.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That's interesting. So, okay, let's talk about after the war a little bit here, because that's what your book focuses on. And okay, so what was the whole idea about letting Confederates go home and turn in their guns, and that's going to like keep them from rebelling again? And there was this whole like debate about that's a bad idea, that's a good idea. What was that?
So I've given a marker of April 9, 1865 as Lee's surrender. One of the things the book does is to explain that is a really important endpoint, and it's the endpoint that Americans know best. We can almost visualize it. In fact, if you see Spielberg's film, it's actually in the movie. A piece of that surrenders there. So the first thing is to explain that one of the things I'm doing in my book is to explain that is an endpoint, but it's not the endpoint. And in fact, it's hard to find a single endpoint. And just as an example, when Lee surrenders, there's a whole nother major Confederate army in North Carolina under Joe Johnston. So that's a huge army that's still in the field. There's a lot of, maybe upwards around 50,000 Confederate troops west of the Mississippi River. And then you've got other issues that sort of make the war go on, such as the U.S. being in a state of war. And now I'm just going to jump ahead and then I'll come back and answer your question, another endpoint, another way to think about an end of a war is a legal ending. When does the law say that the war is over?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a legal end of the Civil War, and it's August 20th. 1866, which is 16 months after that Appomattox surrender. Now, if you want to talk about that later, we can, but that's a teaser to your listeners as to, what this book is about. Like, how do you, mm-hmm. what's going on here that you have a legal end so far away from Appomattox?
Right.
But let me go back now and answer your question, because in that Appomattox moment, that surrender, there's a couple things that really stand out. Obviously, the Lee signing the surrender agreement to Grant is a big deal, and always portrayed as two gentlemen, a very gracious surrender. And at that moment of surrender, there is a discussion about guns. So already guns are on the table, if you will. It's going to be part of the surrender ceremony that happens a couple days later, the stacking of arms, which is that the Confederates who have their rifles, either their own rifles or army issued, no matter, those are to be stacked in a ceremonial stacking of arms. That's really important.
Nice. Yeah.
But one of the things that Lee says in this discussion, and one of the things they talk about, is sidearms, pistols and such, right? Because the officers tend to have sidearms. These are their personal guns. And they agree, Lee and Grant, that the officers can keep their sidearms. And then Lee says, well, some of the non-officers have sidearms too, so can they keep them? And Grant basically says yes. All right, so they keep their sidearms. But the idea is, when they go home, they don't have rifles. And furthermore, when they go home, any stores of guns obviously should not be under Confederate control. That's pretty much assumed, right? That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Now we get to the point where I think you're going, which is, that's April 9. Now we go ahead a few weeks, a little bit over two weeks, but there's a long negotiation with that other army, with the army under Joe Johnston, who's negotiating with General William Tecumseh Sherman. And this is happening in North Carolina. And that is a whole nother surrender. And that is another story. Yeah. And what happens there is, there's a first draft of a surrender agreement. And that first draft includes a provision in which, when the Confederates go home, they will actually, if they promise, if they take their oath of loyalty and they promise not to take up arms again, they get to control the arsenals at home. That seems counterintuitive, maybe downright stupid, right? Like, you're going to let the enemy go control. The reasoning here, though, actually is not quite as crazy as you might think. First, I'll point out that people at the time on the Union side, they did think it was crazy. They used it as one of many pieces of evidence that Sherman was really doing a terrible job negotiating a surrender. Mm. And in the end, that draft is overturned. It's disapproved. And a new draft is made that looks very much like the Appomattox surrender. But what in the world was Sherman thinking when he did this? So that's, now I come to the nub of the matter. Like, why would a general do that? And what he's thinking is that when the Confederates go home, they're home, but there's going to be a lot of people who still want to make war. There's going to be guerrillas. There's going to be white, what we know to be, right, white paramilitary troops. And how do you control them? How do you put them down? And Sherman's notion was, the U.S. Army can only do so much against the people. If the former Confederate Army acts in an honorable fashion, they will help us. They will help us make peace. If they're armed and they're true to the peace deal, they themselves will police their areas and make sure that guerrilla warfare and such is put down. In other words, the problem of insurrection, which of course is always a problem when you try to end a war, you can't stop insurrectionaries from being insurrectionaries. Sherman understood that, and he thought the Confederate Army, as gentlemen, would help in the effort. I guess it's a bit of a crazy move in my book, because the general consensus when they look at that first draft, historians and people at the time, is they really come down hard on Sherman as basically willing to make a peace where he sort of gives everything away to the Confederates. Mm-hmm. And there's some truth to that. However, now let's think ahead quite a bit, and maybe I shouldn't be making this comparison, but you see what you think. When Saddam Hussein falls in the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the early 2000s, one of the first things that's done is that the Iraqi army is disbanded by U.S. and its allies. Mm-hmm. And there are voices at the time, U.S. voices, saying, don't do that. We need that army. We need the Iraqi army, because if we can get that army on our side, they can help put down insurrectionaries. And sure enough, years later, many years later, so the army is disbanded and insurrection is the problem in Iraq, one of the problems, but a big problem. And you can find articles where military strategists are saying you should never have disbanded Hussein's army, which sounds, again, crazy unless you think about it in these terms. So I made the comparison, and I don't know what you think of that, but it's a little out there, you know?
That is one point for the idea of studying military history before you make military decisions.
It's also fascinating that Sherman, of all people, right? What is Sherman known for the most? Sherman's known for marching across Georgia and doing devastation to the South, right? He's not known for this thing where he, arguably, it's the most generous possible thing you could do to the South. He's known for being the most severe general there was. How do you square these things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one way you square it is it's a different time. And it obviously seems naive to us and probably was naive. But when you really believe in honor, and honor is the key. I mean, that's the whole point of the Appomattox surrender is honor. This honor that, yeah, we're going to let you go. We're not going to, you don't have to stick around and be put on trial. We're not going to put you on trial. We might put you on trial later. But for now, go home. Go home.
Yeah.
Right? Plant your crops. Do what you got to do. And you know, and it's the honor system. And we're not going to mess with you when you go home. And you don't mess with us. And that's the honor system. So Sherman's just taking that to a rather broader extreme, I guess. Yeah. So we know, right, that if we look fairly soon after the spring of 1865, we start looking especially into the fall and then really into the spring of 66. What do we see? We see former Confederates regaining control of the state governments, pledging their faith, their allegiance to the Union, while meanwhile, on the sly, of course, or maybe not so much on the sly, supporting white paramilitary groups that are aimed at insurrection, attacking Black Americans in the South, attacking U.S. troops in the South. So when you know all that, as we do, that is to say that the former Confederates, let me put it this way, did not behave with the kind of honor that maybe was there at that moment at Appomattox. We know that that happened. Then we look back and we say, what was Sherman thinking, right? Because we know what happened, so why would Sherman have given the store away right from the get-go?
Yeah.
And that was not true at the Appomattox agreement. Lincoln was alive. The assassination of Lincoln changes everything, really, because now Sherman and his counterpart, Johnston, and others, it's not just Johnston who's there during the negotiations, John Breckinridge is there, but everyone is actually really worried, especially that the Union troops are going to blame the Confederacy for the assassination of Lincoln, and there will be reprisals. There will be horrific violence. And so we better get a peace deal that's as complete, as comprehensive as possible, because the rage that exists among Union troops is equal to, if not greater than, the desire among Confederates to keep up the fight. It's easy to forget that this was a coordinated assassination. A bunch of people were supposed to be assassinated. And it turns out there were only two real attempts, one successful against Lincoln and the other against Seward, which was came very close to successful and nearly killed him.
That one was crazy.
Yes. And that one, the Seward attempt is absolutely crazy. And I do describe it partly because it's just such an amazing story. That it's an amazing story that he lives. And his son is there to help save him. So to put yourself in that time, if you're in the Union, if you're a Northerner, and you learn these things, it isn't just a lone gunman has killed the president. That's bad enough. That's horrible, right?
Right.
This is a plot, a vast plot. And it was vast, right? So, you know, nine people are convicted of a conspiracy. One is out of the country, four hanged, and four sent to prison.
It would feel like, oh my God, it's happening again. They're coming at us again.
Right. Now, it's another thing. Yeah, if they did it once, they might do it again. I think Stanton, the Secretary of War, who's in charge of the investigation, has a bodyguard, and he advises his fellow cabinet members that they should have bodyguards, too. I mean, the government, right? They're like, we don't know exactly what we're dealing with here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really scary to think about.
Yeah.
Can I ask you before we go, is there any other books that you're working on that we can see after this? Because you've written quite a lot of books, so just kind of curious.
Well, I am actually working on a book about military history of a different sort. And that is, I've gotten very interested in military prisons. And by that, I do not mean POW camps. Oh. I mean prisons where soldiers are sent by their own side.
Oh.
Sometimes, right? Sometimes civilians, but soldiers. So today, if I say to you, Fort Leavenworth, right?
Yeah.
Probably right away, because you're a military historian, it signals something to you, right? What does it signal? And it signals this is a place where U.S. soldiers, the military, who have broken military law or whatever, that's where they're sent to prison. So that's Fort Leavenworth. There's a whole nother facility in Annapolis for the Navy, another military facility. What I'm interested in is in the Civil War, is where are U.S. military prisoners sent who desert? They stand up their commanders and they're called mutinous. Sometimes they just admit they're minor infractions. They fall asleep on the post, whatever, right? So sometimes it's a light, whatever, court-martial, light punishment. But I am very interested in the prisons where these people are sent. And Fort Leavenworth ends up being one of these places, but that's kind of later that it becomes it eventually becomes the official single prison. For my time, I'm fully focused on Dry Tortugas, which is a small island off of Key West. And that is where Fort Jefferson is, which is a massive, massive fort, still there, or the relics are still there. It's a national park. It's a national park, Dry Tortugas, and it's dominated by the fort. The fort was not built to be a prison, but it becomes, over time, more than 2,200 people serve time there, and of soldiers. They're almost all soldiers. Actually, the four Lincoln assassins who are not hanged, that's where they're sent. They're sent to Dry Tortugas. They're sent to Fort Jefferson. So it's the Guantanamo Bay of the 19th century. And I'm not the first person to say that. It really is.
Yeah.
Because you're sending people as far away as you can. They don't have access to lawyers. It's obviously almost impossible to escape, although there's some pretty awesome stories of people escaping. And all that you could kind of want in dramatic stories of military, I'm leaving a lot out. But I've been working on this for a few years, and I'm discovering new things all the time. So that's next.
That's going to be awesome. Wow. Oh, man, I bet there's so many things to cover with that. Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all of these questions, Michael Vorenberg. I think that if you know a lot about the Civil War, you're probably going to find things in here that maybe you haven't heard. If you don't know anything about it, it's going to teach you a lot of information we didn't cover. I would definitely recommend it. So thank you again for coming on the show.
Yes, and thank you for letting me talk a little bit about Lincoln's peace, the struggle to end the Civil War. And it was a lot of fun to write, learned a lot, and I really appreciate coming on your show. And so thanks a lot.
Okay, all right, bye.
Okay, bye.